This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, President Clinton's budget contains big increases in spending for the environment. Will they survive in the Republican Congress? Medicine containing parts of wild tigers is sold in the United States. It's not good for tigers, and it's illegal, but you can still buy it. We go fishing on a moonless black night in the black waters off the Everglades. And on the Earth calendar, it's the Great American Harvest, tangerine picking in Arizona. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. This is the Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. At the beginning of February, President Clinton submitted his budget for fiscal year 1999 to the Congress. This year, the president proposes to increase overall environmental spending by 5%, but some programs would get substantially more. He proposes a 40% increase in EPA funding for toxic waste cleanup through Superfund, a 33% increase in Department of Energy spending on efficiency and renewable resources, and a 42% increase in Department of Interior funding for endangered species programs. Katie McGinty is chair of the Council on Environmental Quality. She spoke to us about the president's budget from her office in the White House.
We see significant increases in this budget across the board, whether it is the budgets for the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Park Service, the agencies that manage our public lands, or whether it is new initiatives designed not only to manage the resources we have, to take care and implement the environmental statutes that we have today, but now to put us on the map looking to the next generation of environmental protection.
McGinty says the budget supports the administration's efforts to change the direction of the Forest Service to ecosystem management rather than just logging. I asked her if the increase for endangered species would be enough to clean up the backlog in the listing of species caused in part by the moratorium Congress imposed in the budget a couple of years ago.
One year, there is no way we would be able to get in front of where we are especially short, and that is in putting together recovery plans for the many species that have been listed. We have been making a tremendous amount of progress in that regard, but the backlog is so enormous that we will not get that job done this year, but it only speaks again to the incredible importance of picking up the cudgels that the president has picked up here, which is to say these are programs that have been underfunded, and we need to begin to give them the resources that are essential if people are going to get the job done right. Another thing I wanted to mention also about our requested increase for the Endangered Species Act itself is that it really is part of a larger effort that we have launched both in this budget and prior to it to protect America's open spaces, protect our quality of life, protect and preserve America's great places.
Congressman Sherwood Bollard from upstate New York, who is regarded as perhaps the greenest Republican in the House and who previously fought off attempts by his colleagues to gut major environmental statutes, is cautious because he says the budget assumes a tobacco settlement and revenue from communication spectrum rights, which are still hypothetical. He's optimistic about getting more money for toxic waste cleanup, but thinks the endangered species increase will not come easy.
It's going to be a challenge to have that level of increase because there are a number of people who are not supportive of our aggressive program to protect endangered species. But I think when all is said and done, the majority will prevail in terms of having increased funding in this area rather than level or decreasing funding. But it's going to be a battle. It's going to be a battle on every single front.
Open space protection is a theme of proposed expenditures for the Land and Water Conservation Fund, funds which come from royalties paid by oil drillers. A $270 million proposal would cover projects from expansion of Yellowstone Park and completion of the Appalachian Trail to the acquisition of Civil War battlefields. Clinton's budget also deals with climate change. Tax cuts and incentives for modernizing homes and physical plant are strategies being proposed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Again, Katie McGinty.
It's about tax cuts for American families so that they can buy the most fuel-efficient vehicles, the most efficient air conditioners and home appliances, indeed, that they can buy the home that is built on the basis of the Model Energy Code, a home that will save them money over the long haul with reduced energy bills and improve the comfort and the livability of the home. No more drafty windows and things like that. But putting money in the pockets of every individual so that they can buy those things that represent our cleanest, our best technology. Not just American families, American businesses as well. Trying to give business incentives to turn over that dirty, inefficient technology they may be using to buy and implement and use cleaner, more efficient, more productive technologies in every element of their operations.
Congressman Bullard is optimistic about the prospect for increases on spending for energy efficiency and renewable resources.
I think that is realistic because we know that fossil fuels, if we continue to be dependent upon fossil fuels, we're going to continue to have serious environmental problems. So we're trying to do things a better way. But whether it's this program or any of the initiatives being advanced, you've got to deal with the realities that we're operating in a climate where there is a mad dash toward a balanced budget.
Bullard's support for environmental programs in the past has not been shared by the majority of the Republican House caucus. On numbers of occasions, however, he's been able to organize enough of his colleagues who, together with House Democrats, have been able to pass environmental legislation on a bipartisan basis. If the pattern is repeated with respect to the environmental programs in the budget, Katie McGinty's optimism will prove justified. A report recently released by two environmental groups shows North America continues to be a key market for medicines containing tiger parts. While the animals are endangered and protected by law, some merchants continue providing products for those still using traditional Chinese medicines. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott looks at the report and efforts now underway to stop the illegal trade in 1998, which just happens to be the Chinese Year of the Tiger.
The report, released by the Wildlife Conservation Society and World Wildlife Fund, shows a large number of retail stores in North American Chinatowns sell medicines containing tiger parts, despite a 20-year-old international ban. The six-month study looked at shops in New York, San Francisco, Atlanta, Los Angeles, Seattle, Toronto, and Vancouver. Jeanette Hemley is Director of International Wildlife Policy at World Wildlife Fund.
What we found was that in about half of all the shops surveyed, 110 shops were surveyed, about half the shops contained or carried medicines that are labeled as containing tiger bone. We also found some products that are purporting to contain rhinoceros horn, bear gallbladder, products coming from the endangered musk deer, and many other endangered species. So in essence, what we have found is there are more stores carrying endangered species medicine products today than we found in a similar survey undertaken 5 years ago, which is ironic because of all the attention that has been going to the whole plight of the tiger. The fact is we have a problem right in our own backyard with the illegal trade of these medicines.
It's estimated that 150,000 over-the-counter traditional Chinese medicines containing endangered species are sold in the U.S. each year. This at a time when the total number of tigers remaining in the wild is fewer than 6,000. That's down from 100,000 at the turn of the century. But the question is, if the products are illegal, how are they getting into the country? Jeanette Hemley says the most common method for importing tiger medicines is mislabeling them as food products.
They come in on ocean cargo liners to the major ports of entry on the West Coast and to New York, and simply they're getting in because customs officers aren't paying attention to what's going on. They're looking the other way, or they've got other priorities. They're focusing their attention on, understandably, other big issues like drug interdiction and so forth. But our concern is that there hasn't been enough political attention on the issue. And as a result, these products are slipping into the country. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is charged with overseeing wildlife product imports, is very understaffed. But at the same time, they haven't done enough to really address the problem with the resources that they do have.
But the products containing tiger parts wouldn't be coming into the U.S. if there wasn't a market. The fact is that some Asian Americans still consider such medicines to be effective treatments. Li Xin Huang is president of the American College of Traditional Chinese Medicine in San Francisco, an educational center for those studying traditional Chinese medicine. She says Asians have been using medicines made from today's endangered species for the past 2,500 years.
Tiger bones are, you know, most popular use in some of the Chinese medicine. In the clinical term of Chinese medicine, it has a warm effect, which eases cold conditions such as body pain. The cold condition for which tiger bone is most often prescribed is rheumatism or arthritis. Other indications include weakness, stiffness, or paralysis of muscles and bones, especially in the lower back and legs.
Wong believes many Chinese and Asian Americans are still using such medicines simply because they don't realize the animals are endangered. She says the American College of Traditional Chinese Medicine is working to change this.
When we educate the Chinese community here in San Francisco, we began that about 3 weeks ago. We passed the right message to them. First of all, we're doing this project together with World Wildlife Fund, and this is a, you know, environmental protection. The wildlife conservation is very important to the, you know, human beings and to the future of the generation of the children. And they have a slogan saying, "Let us save a few tigers in wildlife for our children."
Besides increasing public awareness about tiger populations and the black market, environmentalists say increased law enforcement efforts are needed, as well as stricter federal regulations and better forensic tools to identify medicines as containing tiger and other endangered species. Just recently, New Jersey U.S. Representative Jim Saxton introduced a bill that would place tougher sentences for those found importing and exporting tiger and rhino medicines. Another bill recently introduced would increase funding for the Rhinoceros and Tiger Conservation Act, which helps fund conservation efforts in 10 countries. Whether these efforts slow the decline of tigers remains to be seen. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a national production which is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector Car Hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. We're interested in your ideas about the environment. Give us a call. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. You don't need to listen to The Environment Show to know it's a good idea to recycle plastic containers. Not commonly understood is all plastic is not the same, and some cannot be recycled at all. Plastic items should have a symbol embossed on them, which consists of a triangle with a number in the middle. Numbers run from 1 to 7. On a plastic soda bottle, it's close to the bottom and a little smaller than a dime. The number denotes the type of plastic the container is made out of. Containers marked 1 and 2 are good raw material for the recycling process. The same is true of plastic bags marked 2 or 4. Code 7 is put on mixture layered plastic, which does not have recycling potential. The cap on your soda bottle is made of a different plastic than the bottle itself. So if it does not have a numbered symbol on it, toss it out. When all those bottles are getting melted down in the recycling pot, a small amount of the wrong type of plastic can ruin the whole stew. That's our green tip for this week. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Peter Jenkins, it's a place in the water off Everglades National Park where the blackness comes in various shades. In this portrait of place, Jenkins reads from his book titled Along the Edge of America.
After dark, I was going out to the islands with Larry. We were going, that is, if Larry's banana tree told him to. Larry used his banana tree to gauge fishing conditions. When the banana leaves brushed up against the kitchen window, that meant the wind was up and it would be too rough to fish. If the banana tree was still, that was a sign to Larry that the conditions were good to find fish. The banana tree had been scraping against the window early in the afternoon, so we sat in the kitchen and drank coffee while we waited to see what would happen. Doug, Larry's fishing partner from Everglades City, waited with us. If the winds laid down, as they said, then we would leave the hill, which is what these people called the land, and go searching into the night for fish. We'd head into the maze of gray-black sky, the still darker islands, and black, shiny water. There would be no moonlight. Larry said he would be navigating by discerning different shapes and shades of black in the night. Evening approached, and the winds seemed to be calming. Larry and Doug were getting excited. These fishermen, every one of them, became visibly stimulated when the waters and winds and temperature gave them the chance to try again to catch the always anticipated, almost never realized net full of fish. Larry and Doug loaded up the boat with ice and cold water and windbreakers. Larry cleaned out his little coffee pot. He knew we'd be needing it. Saltwater fishermen love these moonless nights because they can see the fish as they fire. Like neon lights, fish glow an eerie, pale green underwater. The darker the night, the more visible the fire beneath the water. Because of the glowing shapes the fish make underwater, and because Larry knew how to read these shapes and movements, we could see the fish far better at night than any time during the day. Depending on the way a fluorescent green shape moves and the size of the shape, Larry can tell what kind of fish it is. If it's a ladyfish, it darts wild and crazy, fast and confused. If it's a mullet, it's more stationary. It goes up near the surface and then sinks down. If it's a small shark and it's spooked, it flares off to the side of the boat. Or if it's a really, really large shark and not startled, it will just ease away, moving in slow motion, a 7-foot-long lightning bug. Pompano show as little squatty shapes that sink in deep water or dart and skip in shallow water. Pompano are very fast and smart. And a school of big black drum can look like the 4th of July underwater. All of this I would be learning before the night was over, but it was all completely new to me, fishing on the blackest of black seas, with the green glow of different sized fish here and there, alone and together, darting off or staying in one place. I was stunned at Larry's ability to navigate by feel, by the time traveled, by the sound his propeller made, and by the many shades of blackness. The surrounding black night air rushed by me as my eyes began to adjust to the darkness and recognize shapes in the black on black before us. Everything was in textures of black, dull black, shiny black, reflecting black. The islands covered with mangrove trees looked like black camouflage cloth. The sky was a clear, darker black. The water was a shiny black, and there was a barely perceptible difference in blackness between channel water, shallows, open bays. Larry acted so comfortable in the blackness.
That was author Peter Jenkins, reading from his book, Along the Edge of America. It's published by Mariner Books. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, tangerines are being harvested in Arizona. It's part of the Great American Harvest. Eagle Produce, located outside of Phoenix, has about 400 acres of tangerine trees. Citrus has been growing there for more than 30 years. Farm manager Peter Martori says it takes about 7 years for trees to be mature enough to produce quality tangerines. Once the tree begins producing fruit, more elaborate monitoring efforts begin to ensure that trees are getting enough nutrients.
But we water generally about every 2 weeks, 10 days to 2 weeks in the hot summer period, and on lessening to about every 30 days in the winter period. We fertilize twice a year, may have to get involved in frost protection if there's some cold nights. Canals will, say, get under 28 degrees. We can get damage where the cells of the fruit sacks break and then dry out. So we use watering at night because the water temperature is generally much warmer than the air temperature.
It's a little less than a year before tangerines are ready to be harvested. Martori says the fruit is ready to be picked when it meets the sugar content standards set by state and marketing cooperatives. He says groups of 15 to 10 people harvest the tangerines with the use of ladders.
The system we use, generally the crews work as a team, and they sort of split what they make. So there's not as, they're sort of self-supervised and don't have to, fill up their bag all the way and have people check them and stuff like that, just because they've been doing this a long time. But on tangerines, they're clipped. They're used, little small hand clipper to clip the stem as close to the button as you can, and being careful not to to puncture skin anyway. Because in a tangerine has what we call a zipper skin. Once you dig your fingernail into it or whatever, it just zips right off. It's very easy to come off. So if you were to pull it, you'd pop the top of the skin off.
Dancy tangerines are considered the traditional Christmas tangerines in the United States. They have a distinctive sweet tart flavor with a lot of seeds and deep reddish-orange skin. Honey tangerines have high sugar, and they provide a rich, sweet flavor. Whether it's Dancy or honey, Martori says there are certain characteristics customers should look for.
They should look for firmness. They can, and this is pretty true of most eating citrus, is you can pick up a few pieces of fruit and get a sense of the weight of the fruit, and then you don't want to, when you're making your selection, if the fruit seems unusually light, then you probably wouldn't want to buy that. Because as fruit ages, it starts to dry out on the top. It's called granulation. And it has less fruit in it. If it feels lighter to you, choose something else. But the other thing is to look around the stem. If the what's called the button, which is sort of a little like collar around where a stem was attached to the fruit. if that's firmly on there, that's an even better sign of freshness.
From tangerine berry salad to fruity tropical drinks and aromatherapy oils, tangerines are used in virtually every way possible. In fact, it's said they are effective cold remedies. Tangerine peels that have been cut into 1-inch squares, left to dry for a week, and eaten will reportedly stop a runny nose. But then again, even an El Nino floodwater could recede in that amount of time. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley.
Tangerine. She is all they claim, with her eyes of night and lips as bright as flame.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, El Niño in California has brought disaster, but there are some benefits as well. We talk green about swordfish. Should we stop eating them to save those that are left? Environmentalists and fishermen disagree. And our ear to the ground meets a man who wants us to kick the tree habit and use treeless paper. It's made with a plant called knaf. Stay with us. The warm water phenomenon known as El Niño continues to play havoc with weather patterns across the United States. Floridians have experienced heavy rains, flooding, and tornadoes. But it's California that appears to be suffering the worst. Flooding and mudslides are causing millions of dollars in damage all along the Golden State coastline. However, not all the news is bad. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more.
December, January, and February are normally the wettest months in California, but storms caused by El Niño have compounded this year's rainy season. The annual rainfall average along the Sacramento River is 49 inches. That number has already been exceeded at 51, halfway through the season. State officials say reservoir operations are currently helping in flood control. The reservoirs, operated according to standards set by the federal U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, store large amounts of water. When heavy rains occur, water is stored. When the rains slow down, water is released, regulating the levels. But not all the water can be controlled. Rain-soaked topsoil has triggered landslides in areas prone to the problem, according to Earl Cummings, a relief information officer for the state of California.
And we have had landslides that have temporarily closed some of our highways. So those sorts of things happen even in normal winters. I think so far we haven't had any extremely catastrophic landslides, but if you happen to be a person whose home is threatened and you've been evacuated from the area, that inconvenience and that risk to your home is certainly serious.
Landslides in Sonoma County and Ventura are forcing many residents to leave their homes, but some haven't been so fortunate. Death toll estimates from El Niño-related storms have reportedly climbed to 10. Damage estimates are also climbing. The first damage reports calculated by the Office of Emergency Services puts costs at around the $300 million range.
We're still tallying numbers because, particularly as we get further and further into the year, there are damages associated with agriculture because there can be damage to orchard crops by high groundwater that suffocates the roots of orchard trees. We may not know until April or May, when those trees fail to leaf out, that there has been damage. There are other effects on agricultural operations with the rainfall preventing farmers from getting in to cultivate or plant.
Meantime, forecasters are using airplanes, normally used in tracking hurricanes, to monitor storms developing over the Pacific Ocean to help state officials prepare for more wet weather. But not everyone is cursing El Niño's wrath. Earl Cummings says the rainstorms may actually be a blessing for some.
the interesting thing was that people that do surfing were having just a wonderful season this year because of the huge swells, and it just seemed like a wonderful plus to them to have this kind of a season. The places that rely on snowfall, for example, that the ski areas are probably going to have an extended recreational season this year. We also are looking for substantial amounts of water in our reservoirs for so people that are engaged in lake rest recreation will probably have full reservoirs.
Cummings says while there may be short-term fruit and vegetable shortages with some California crops, the rainfall will provide for irrigation through the summer. He also says the waters will help fisheries and some threatened species.
We need substantial outflow to protect things like Chinook salmon. And fortunately, in years like this, species that during droughts are rendered extremely at risk of extirpation or extinction make marvelous recoveries. So in many cases, things that dry years cause problems, these wet years reverse those problems. So even though it's inconvenient to have sustained high water, even though it's inconvenient to have to adjust our reservoir management to provide for flood protection, the upside is that we're recovering fisheries that have been threatened for years.
Weather forecasters are predicting El Nino to remain active through April, which means the full impacts of this weather phenomenon won't be known for some time. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're talking about swordfish and a campaign called Give Swordfish a Break. A group of about 30 prominent chefs from the East Coast has announced that they will not serve swordfish in their restaurants for at least a year, hoping that this will give swordfish populations a chance to recover. Swordfish are caught on both the East Coast and the West Coast, and it is reported that the average weight of a swordfish reaching our fish markets has declined from 250 pounds in the 60s to about 90 pounds today. So the question is, should we stop eating swordfish? What do you think? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. And my guests are Lisa Speer. She's Senior Policy Analyst from the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is a national environmental group that is sponsoring the Give Swordfish a Break campaign. She's in New York. Also with us is Nelson Biedemann, and he is Executive Director of the Blue Water Fishermen's Association. And that's an association which represents commercial fishermen and vessel owners and fish dealers on both the East and the West Coast and in the Caribbean. And they catch and sell some of the swordfish, which will be the subject of our discussion. So, Lisa, let's start with you. Why should we stop eating swordfish?
The purpose of the campaign we have launched is to educate consumers and chefs about the plight of swordfish in the North Atlantic Ocean, and to enlist them as advocates on behalf of conservation. The goal of the campaign is to secure prompt and effective government action to restore this magnificent fish to its former levels of abundance in the North Atlantic within 10 years. And by North Atlantic, I should explain that we mean waters of the Atlantic Ocean north of the 5-degree north latitude line, which hits at about Venezuela. The population in the North Atlantic is defined by that line for management purposes.
Okay, so that what you're saying is that if people stop eating swordfish, that this will promote further government action. Nelson Biedemann, representing the folk that catch the fish, I presume this is not a good idea from your perspective.
Not a good idea from our perspective, and not a good idea from the international conservation program perspective either. The attempted swordfish boycott will be ineffective and primarily harm the responsible fishermen that are working under the International Conservation Program of the International Commission for the conservation of Atlantic tunas.
Well, let's see if there's any agreement on any of these issues between you. Nelson, should further action be taken to protect the swordfish populations of the Atlantic, or are they doing okay?
No. North Atlantic swordfish populations have declined, and we have an international body in place that has set quotas below the replacement levels, and we need time for that program to take effect. In the past, there's been compliance problems with the international program, and U.S. and Canadian fishermen have fought for and achieved in 1996 a very severe compliance penalty package that goes into full effect this year, 1988.
So do I hear you saying that if the existing rules are enforced, the swordfish are going to be okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Lisa?
First of all, I want to agree with Mr. Biedemann that international action to protect swordfish is absolutely essential. That said, the U.S. catches almost a third of the North Atlantic swordfish quota. We thus have a responsibility to take aggressive action, and our actions to restore this fish in domestic waters can have a significant impact. It is true that all fishing nations for North Atlantic swordfish should contribute to their restoration, but U.S. conservation efforts should start immediately within our own waters. Those efforts will start swordfish on the road to recovery and put us in a far better negotiating position for to argue for complementary international action at the international level.
Well, Lisa, one of the things that I heard Nelson saying, though, is that if the existing rules are enforced, that the populations will survive or recover. Do you agree with that, or do you think you're going to have further restrictions than exist now?
Further restrictions are clearly necessary if this population is to be brought back to a level capable of producing maximum sustainable catches within 10 years, which is what U.S. federal law now requires and what this campaign is calling for.
And what would those restrictions be?
There are a number of things that we can do both domestically and internationally to protect this fish. On the domestic side, we can do things like protect nursery areas for swordfish. These are areas where young fish congregate. The gear that many fishermen use to catch swordfish in the North Atlantic is known as long lines. These are very long lines, up dozens of miles long, baited with hundreds of hooks. And these hooks are largely incapable of distinguishing between a big swordfish and a little swordfish, or a swordfish and other species for that matter. And when deployed in areas where juvenile fish, young fish congregate, these long lines catch very large numbers of young fish that have not yet reached reproductive age. Fishermen in the United States fishing for swordfish discarded 40,000 juvenile fish because they were under the minimum size in 1996. This kind of problem can be helped by keeping long lines out of nursery areas, areas where juvenile fish congregate, so that these young fish can grow to adulthood and reproduce.
Nelson, from the Fishermen's Association, does any of this make any sense from the perspective of your members?
Well, some of it makes sense, but the environmental industry has been totally inconsistent concerning juvenile catches of swordfish and tunas. Even though Atlantic bluefin stocks are in much worse shape than Atlantic swordfish, they raise no concern about excessive juvenile catches of bluefin. Why? All juvenile bluefin are caught by recreational fishing industry, while most swordfish are caught by the commercial fishing industry.
So what I hear you saying is that you think the commercial fishermen are being picked on, and
absolutely. And we've been abiding by all the international and domestic regulations. In fact, we have proactively pressed for the ICAT quotas and the ICAT reduction of quotas to below the replacement yield level. Now, in 1997, 98, and 99, those quotas, international quotas, are set below replacement yield, and if American fishermen are abiding by their share of that quota and staying below that replacement yield level, we're not overfishing Atlantic swordfish. The focus should be on compliance or non-compliance of the international program.
Well, let me ask you something. Is it your experience and the experience of your members that indeed there is not compliance? I heard you talk about American fishermen as opposed to others. First, are American fishermen now complying, and are there people from other nations who are not, as you see it?
In the past, there have been problems with compliance, and we achieved a very severe compliance penalty package that goes into effect this year. Now, international management is slow, but it's the only effective way we have to manage a stock of fish that travels throughout the Atlantic Ocean.
Lisa, how about that? I gather one of the things that Nelson is saying is that even if you reduce American intake, which I guess is what the campaign to give swordfish a break would do, that other fishers and other markets will simply continue the high level of exploitation that's going on.
First of all, I think there's no question that the U.S. fishermen are largely playing by the rules, as Mr. Biedemann said. The problem is that the rules aren't strong enough, and they need to be strengthened at both the domestic and the international levels. We have called for action both domestically and internationally to reduce the catch and restore this fish back to its former abundance. And the good news is these fish will come back, and they will come back relatively quickly if we give them a break. And if we do that, everyone will benefit. Commercial fishermen, recreational fishermen, consumers, restaurants, all of us will benefit from the restoration of this population.
And so the real issue, as I see it, if the American fishermen, if there's agreement that they seem to be playing according to the rules, the real question between you then is whether the rules are tough enough. What is the science, and I ask you both this, that would indicate that if we continue to take at the existing levels, they'll either come back or they won't? Nelson, what do your people say about that? Are they confident that we're now below a replacement level so that if the limits are held?
We're confident that if all the harvesting nations throughout the range of the stock of Atlantic swordfish comply with the international program, that these fish will come back relatively quickly.
And
now,
what we're
offering out to the restaurants and supermarkets, et cetera, is an alternative to this boycott. And that alternative is in the form of a commitment to provide customers with swordfish that are harvested in full compliance with all fishery conservation measures, and a petition to the Secretary of Commerce to take immediate steps to ensure that any Atlantic swordfish in our markets were harvested in compliance with the ICAT conservation program.
Now, let me just follow up on that for a moment. Suppose I want to go buy swordfish at my local fish market. Is there any way that I can tell now whether that was fish that was caught in compliance with the rules or whether it was caught some other way? Or
if the government places import measures at our borders to prevent undersized Atlantic swordfish or swordfish in excess of an ICAT country-specific quota from coming into this market, American consumers will have assurance that the swordfish in their supermarkets or restaurants has been caught under the International Conservation Program.
Lisa, and would that work?
We have supported those measures and will continue to support import restrictions that affect fish that have been taken in a manner that is not consistent with the ICAT rules.
Now, is there anything in place today that tells the consumer whether this stuff's been caught according to the rules or not? Is there any way that when you walk into the fish market, you've got a way to figure that out?
Peter?
Yes, Nelson, go ahead.
Approximately 30 million pounds of swordfish consumed in the United States today. Of that, two-thirds of that swordfish are caught in the Pacific, where swordfish are not overfished. Of the one-third that's caught in the Atlantic, 70% of that is caught by U.S. and Canadian fishermen that are fully complying with the conservation program. So that leaves very little that possibly may be slipping through compliance that comes into the U.S.
But if that's the case, shouldn't the populations be stable now rather than declining? Lisa, what do your numbers tell you about the population figures?
Well, unfortunately, Peter, here in this country and elsewhere, the science, the money that we spend on science to study the oceans isn't what it should be. And we don't have a completely clear picture of what will happen under different scenarios. But it is clear that these fish are in serious trouble and that further measures are needed to restore this population back to a level consistent with producing the maximum sustainable catches within 10 years, which is what the U.S. law requires. With respect to import measures, we think they're very important and would agree with Mr. Vitamin that those should be pursued vigorously. But the problem is that the measures that have been adopted by ICAT to date are not sufficient to bring this population back within 10 years. In addition, there are other things that could be done to improve international compliance. For example, there was a recent treaty agreement reached at the United Nations to improve the management of fisheries by organizations like ICAT.
Okay, I'm afraid we've only got about 30 seconds left. Nelson, improvement of the rules, how should that be done, in your judgment?
The focus should be on compliance or non-compliance with the international program, and if the international program needs adjusting, then we should all be working together to ensure that that program will do the job for swordfish.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid our time is up. We've been discussing the campaign being organized to have people stop eating swordfish, at least for a time. My guests have been Lisa Speer from the Natural Resources Defense Council and Nelson Vitamin, who is from the Blue Water Fishermen's Association. We want to hear your views about whether eating swordfish should be curtailed. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You don't have to listen to the Environment Show on the radio. You can hear it on your personal computer through our website. The address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. This is the Environment Show, and our Ear to the Ground is next.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, tree-free paper. The demand for paper products is out of control. Just consider the junk mail in your mailbox. Let alone all the faxes, computer printouts, memos, reports, newspapers, packaging, and wrappers that surround you every day. Paper just isn't the precious commodity it once was. And while recycling offers a partial solution to the problem of paper consumption, it's just not enough. Harvesting hardwood trees for wood fiber to make paper has a huge impact on our environment. That's why Bill Detweiler and his marketing research company, D2 Incorporated, want to help set a standard of environmental stewardship within the paper industry. Working with Vision Paper, Detweiler has set out to market what he describes as an environmentally positive paper. Knaf.
Knaf is a plant related to okra. It's in the hibiscus family and has a rather interesting 40-year history in this country. Basically brought over by the Department of Defense, you know, looking for an alternative to hemp, you know, because it was in the national interest to find a self-grown product, which they needed, you know, for World War II, for rope, you know, for boats and towing lines and bags to put rice and coal and whatever else in. And quite honestly, hemp was, you know, one of those products that was not grown in this country. As a matter of fact, people that we were eventually at war with, and they needed an alternative.
Knauf, chosen from thousands of species of plants, hails from Africa and shares many of the properties of hemp, except the recreational qualities. Therefore, Detweiler says, unlike hemp, it's legal. Related to cotton, as well as okra, Knauf grows easily and quickly in the south and southwestern United States. It requires no pesticides, no fertilizers, and grows to a height of 12 to 14 feet. It's ready to harvest in 4 to 5 months, and Detweiler reports Knauf yields 3 to 5 times more product per acre than trees per year. The Knauf stalk has an inner and outer bark, and it's the long cellulose fiber of the outer bark, Detweiler says, that results in a high-grade quality paper that is acid-free and made without the use of chlorine. Being a pioneer with Knauf paper, Detweiler says, though, has not been easy.
At least maybe I'll have a mark in making people aware of the fact that they can do something about, you know, trees and paper, you know, and a combination of jobs versus environment. But the reason it's not done is, quite honestly, a reason that the Japanese were winning the technological wars early in the, you know, 80s was that in the United States, unless you can show a market and profitability, no one will invest in the research and development to create the thing cheap enough that there would be a market. And so it goes round and round and round in the United States that unless you have a sure bet, you can't get the $200 million it would take to put up a mini mill and have farmers grow sufficient quantities to make it a paper that's less than wood fiber paper that would actually start to take over the market. Somebody has to move first.
Detweiler says only one company in the United States is making Knauf paper, and that is Vision Paper. Knauf plants are currently grown in Texas, Mississippi, Kentucky, and Delaware, and the University of Mississippi is conducting research at many of its campuses on its cultivation and uses. Though Detweiler has found American businesses generally unwilling to experiment with the alternative paper, probably until costs can be brought down, it can be found in some catalogs and environmentally focused stores. Detweiler says outside of the United States, Knauf is being grown in Southeast Asia, with Japan busy marketing the stuff. Bill Detweiler believes it's a waste that a huge bulk of our forests are being clear-cut, only to be ground into chips and turned into paper. Trees have many purposes, but making paper, he believes, should not be one of them. Not when there's a more economical and environmentally safe way. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
Bill Detweiler's company, D2 Incorporated, is located in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Next time you go to a fish market, play the salesperson or swordfish discussion on your pocket cassette recorder. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 425. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartuck is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Steve Whateley is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.